All right, our next case for this morning is United States against Ngo. Mr. Habermill.
Good morning. My name is Alan Habermill. I represent the appellant, Tech Ngo. The first part of the case is whether there's a Booker violation at all. I think it's clear that there is. We're only focusing on the career offender at this point because that ended up controlling the decision in the district court. There were some underlying Booker issues about drug quantity, but they don't even come into play unless the career offender drops out. With regard to the career offender status itself, it's our argument that to determine whether Mr. Ngo is a career offender requires finding facts beyond just the mere existence of the convictions themselves. Because in order to tell whether those convictions count, you have to determine whether they're related or not, because the two of them might only be counted as one, and if they were counted as one, then he's not a career offender, because those are the only predicate offenses he had. In that regard, the new decision from the Supreme Court in Shepard, I think, is particularly instructive. I cited it in a supplemental letter to the court, because they're dealing exactly with that issue. If you have to go behind just the facial nature of the convictions themselves to determine what their relevance is to the sentencing process, whether they have some effect on the sentence, then that additional fact-finding violates the Constitution.
So it's your view, just essentially, that Shepard at least narrows Almendarez-Torres?
Narrowed it to the point of extinction, and I think that's what...
Well, I don't know extinction, because there are some things you can see on the record, and the court doesn't tell us they're overruling Almendarez-Torres.
Right. No, and of course, in fact, they went to some length to even dodge the constitutional issue by interpreting the statute so as to avoid it.
Right.
But in doing so, they discussed the constitutional issue. They explained why failing to interpret it that way would be a problem. And I think, again, Justice Thomas's concurrence in Shepard is really instructive there, because he's the swing vote on this, and he counts heads the same as I do. The original four dissenters in Almendarez-Torres plus Justice Thomas makes five, and that's what he says is in his concurrence, and I think he's right. So that's what I meant by extinction. It's suffering the death of a thousand cuts, but I think it's about time is about to go. And I think
it will not,
right,
however, be up to this court to,
I appreciate
to try
that, but
to nail in.
I understand that, although I couldn't just not raise the argument, or the next time I go somewhere, they'll say I waived it. But I don't think this is an Almendarez-Torres issue. That's my point. But just as the way the Supreme Court got around the Sixth Amendment issue in dealing with the Shepard case by saying there are some facts you can't find, I think that's identical.
But Shepard was not a Sixth Amendment case, was it?
It turned out
to be the definition of burglary in...
Well, it would have been if they had decided to interpret the statute to allow the judge to do the extra fact-finding that was required to decide the issue. What they did was dodge the issue by simply reinterpreting the statute so as to simply prohibit the judge from doing the fact-finding, thereby neatly avoiding the problem of who's supposed to do the fact-finding. They just prohibited the finding of facts at all, and that's how it turned out. You can't dodge the issue that way in this case, because in order to resolve the guidelines issue, someone has to find those facts. It's either the judge or the jury. If it's the judge, it violates the Sixth Amendment. Ngo didn't admit the facts, nor were they proven at trial. They weren't part of his plea. All of this came out only at the time of sentencing. It isn't like a weight issue, even with a drug case, where the mandatory minimums go up.
That's pretty clear, though, in your case, in Mr. Ngo's case, that there's no formal order of consolidation.
Well, that's true. I'm not here to argue whether they were or weren't consolidated. I don't think that's the issue. I'm not here to argue to you that they were or weren't related. Again, I don't think that's the issue here. That would be a clear error.
Well, I think it may well be the issue, so I think you better address it.
Well, my argument in the brief is that they were consolidated functionally, given how close in time, given the overlap of identical sentences.
You're relying
for the
on
two.
Essentially a functional consolidation,
yes,
theory, not a formal.
That is correct. And as I cited in the brief, functional consolidation works. There's an alternate way, though, in which they're related, and that's whether they're part of a common scheme or plan. You only have to satisfy one of those two prongs in order for them to be related. And I think they actually satisfy both, but if they satisfy either one, they are. But again, the point is whether or not facts have to be found in order to resolve the question. And I think the answer on that is clearly yes. Facts beyond the mere existence of the conviction themselves. To tell whether they're related, you have to go behind.
Well, if you have a consolidation order, that takes care of that branch of the problem, doesn't it?
If we had one, it would. We do not, I think, in the normal sense of the term here. They were consolidated for sentencing. it's my opinion that given the way the judge treated them, they were functionally consolidated with the overlapping sentences. But again, they're also, I think, part of a common scheme or plan.
Now, they are or they aren't?
They are. The two, I believe the two armed robberies, in my opinion, are. They're 10 days apart. They have overlap of participants. The modus operandi is identical.
But the district court, of course, does find that fact against you because they are 10 days apart. Because
yes.
The law is pretty clear. That I mean, we've even said 2 hours apart isn't enough if you had a chance to change your mind.
I lost the finding of fact. I'm not here to have it asked to have it reviewed for clear error. That is not the issue on this appeal. I didn't raise that on purpose because I knew I would lose it. And so that's not the issue.
Okay.
Neither was Booker. Booker wasn't a question of whether the judge's finding as to the drug quantity was correct or not. Booker was a question about whether it violates the Sixth Amendment for the judge to make the finding at all. That's the question here, and it's the same question. There's a completely alternate ground for reversal, however, and that's the straightforward one, that Mr. Noe was sentenced under a mandatory sentencing guideline scheme that does not exist. The judge applied to career offenders because the guidelines told her she had to. She no longer has to. And that's separate from all of this other issue. That's a straightforward sentencing scheme.
Well, assuming all that to be correct, all that's required is a Palladino remand, isn't it?
On to the next, yes. I believe it needs to be remanded for resentencing. Or I guess I should just state plainly, I don't think that the decision in Palladino can be properly applied in this case to send it for that limited remand. I don't think that it's a reasonable response in a case like this to simply send it back to the judge and say, what would you have done had you had the opportunity?
But why not? I mean, you know, first of all, there's a distinction between this case and Palladino, which we're going to be seeing off and on all morning. Namely, if for whatever reason we were to think there was not a Sixth Amendment problem, and I just want to put that over on the side. I know that you're arguing that there is. But if there were not, then one would have to decide whether on AA are we looking at plain error review in terms of the mandatory discretionary issue. I think we certainly are. I don't see anything in this record that suggests that was preserved. And then the question is, in a sense, does one do a Palladino remand for the statutory level of the Booker decision? Of course, the court fixes the Sixth Amendment problem by changing the statute, and that gives us an interesting blend of constitutional and statutory grounds, and there are going to be some cases, let's say a guilty plea case, where a defendant has admitted the facts, and yet the judge thought his or her hands were tied. So is it your position Palladino remands have to take place even if it's, as it were, a non-constitutional mistake on the part of the judge?
Yes, and the reason why is because this court has routinely, in pre-Booker guidelines cases, applied a plain error analysis to correct legal errors, simple misinterpretations or misapplications of the guidelines because they created a larger sentence than a correct interpretation would have. And it's applied plain error to correct those legal errors. Plain error isn't limited to simply correcting constitutional errors. And we have here what is clearly a legal error in the sense that the Supreme Court has now said they're not mandatory. And so that does need to be corrected by a plain error analysis. The problem with simply sending it back to ask the judge, what would you have done had you only known this at the time, I think is that in a lot of cases, the honest answer is going to have to simply be, I don't know. And I think then if that's what the remand's going to be, the question has to be answered, what if the judge says, I don't know? And the reason I think a judge, in most cases, in fact, ought to be saying, I don't know, is that the question asks the judge to pre-decide an issue that the judge has not heard either the evidence or the arguments on. You're asking the judge to say, well, if the universe of facts relevant to sentencing had been expanded and you could have been told more things, and if people could have made more arguments, what would you have done then? And you're asking the judge to say...
Well, don't we have to send it back to the judge and find out what the judge said before we get into all those problems?
I think you should just send it back to the judge for a sentencing because that's the only way to actually get the facts and the arguments in front of the judge that the judge would need to answer the question in the first place.
It sounds like you're calling into question the whole efficacy of the Palladino procedure. So.
I think it's wrong to simply send it back for that limited question because I don't think the question can be answered without doing the sentencing. And because the original sentencing is just unconstitutional on its face, I think that's a more appropriate response than sending it back for the limited purpose of getting the judge to answer the Palladino question. Yes.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. O'Shea.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm going to address two things this morning. Number one, why, in the government's view, a limited Palladino remand is appropriate in this case. As the court knows, I filed a motion saying we don't need to come down here and take up your time because a Palladino remand is appropriate. The second thing I'm going to address is why the Shepherd case really does not have any bearing on this particular case. Let's talk about why the Palladino remand is appropriate first. Under the law of this circuit, the limited remand is appropriate because the record is bare of any indication of what the district court would do if applying the guidelines in an advisory fashion as opposed to a mandatory regime.
Now, this sentence was at the bottom of the range, right?
Yep.
That the court calculated. So in terms of Lee or something like that, we don't have the kind of signals that she would have felt herself to be,
There are no signals at all. No,
yeah.
And that's why I think it should be remanded. In all candor, I think the district court is probably going to sentence below.
Even if there's not any constitutional error, you think it ought to be remanded?
Absolutely. And I think, Your Honor, there is no constitutional error here in light of this court's decision in Vallejo and also in Morris and, of course, in light of Almendarez-Torres, which, different people argue that it's on the way out, but so far, as Judge Woods points out, it's not this court's call whether or not that.
No, but how about the joint scheme branch of
right.
the problem?
I mean, that's the problem. As Judge Cuddy is saying, we all know there's no formal order of consolidation, mm-hmm. but that has not been the only theory that could be used.
No.
To treat a particular set of past convictions as one or more than one. One of them was factually based. It was hard to prove those facts. In fact, one can look hard to find a case that actually meets it, but you could.
You theoretically could. And if the court is reaching out for this issue, I just want to make quite clear that the defense not only has not preserved that issue, whether or not it's consolidated or not, but has affirmatively said, we're not arguing that, so it's beyond waiver, or it's beyond forfeiture into waiver. But just the same, I think the district court correctly applied the tests and found that these two crimes committed 10 days apart were not necessarily a joint scheme. One did not entail the commission of the other, and there was no consolidation
well,
other than...
Could she make such a determination? Is that her role? That's the issue, isn't it? Isn't that a jury question, or...
And I think, Your Honor, that gets into the whole Shepherd case. The Shepherd case...
Well, that doesn't have anything to do with Shepherd, the point scheme thing, it doesn't seem to me. That's the order of consolidation aspect.
Okay.
What kind of a document do you have to show consolidation? But the other thing is, did this arise as a result of a joint scheme or plan? And that's just a fact-finding, and... The problem we got here under Booker is that the judge found the facts, not the jury. So where's that? Isn't that what we're dealing with here?
That's what we're dealing with, Your Honor. And under Almendarez-Torres and this court's several decisions that I've mentioned, this court and the Supreme Court have said that that's fine, that a district court can find not just a prior conviction, but the nature of those convictions.
Oh, I see what you're arguing. All right.
Okay, but I think that does somewhat segue into Shepherd, because the Shepherd case didn't say that the district court couldn't make findings of fact relating to a prior conviction.
Well, the Shepherd case didn't. No, but the Booker case did. They're two different problems.
Right, right. Yeah. And that's why I believe there is, a Booker... The Booker case also said that the district court could make findings of fact relating to a prior conviction, and that's what we're dealing with here.
The phrase they keep using, whether it's in Blakely or Apprendi or Booker, is any fact other than the fact of a prior conviction, and I guess what we're trying to do is unpack that phrase in
right.
light of what they did
right.
in Shepherd, which I certainly grant you was... a different context, a different kind of problem. This court has seen that problem about what do you do with prior convictions
right.
frequently, and we've said, you shouldn't have mini trials about what they were and so on. But But now the Supreme Court has spoken about what exactly do we mean by the fact of a prior conviction. Do we mean something that you can just go to the clerk's office and read off the docket sheet, or do we mean more detail about it? And they seem to take a pretty narrow approach.
Right.
In Shepard.
And the district court's decision here, in Mr. Noe's case, is completely in conformance with Shepard. What does Shepard say you can use? They say you can use transcripts. They say you can use the charging document and the judgments of conviction. Look at the pre-sentence report, what the pre-sentence report relied on, and the addendum. What they relied on were the charging documents, the transcript of the sentencing, which not only was there these two felony crimes, but three other misdemeanor crimes were all resolved at the same.
But would you be making the opposite argument if the district court had found functional consolidation on the basis of the common scheme theory? I mean, I know that you don't think that's very likely on these facts, but let's just assume for the sake of argument that one could. So the district court looks at the facts, says, gee, in this case, I find it's really a common scheme, and so I'm going to count this as one conviction. Now the government wants to appeal and say, you gave this guy the wrong sentence.
Right. But I think
surely that would be fact-finding, right? And you'd be, so why isn't it fact-finding if the court finds it's not a common scheme?
I think it is fact-finding, and under Morris and Almendarez-Torres and Vallejo, that's perfectly appropriate. You can't. These cases say that you can't just. You can decide more than just the mere existence. You can also find the nature. Think about Almendarez-Torres. They had decided that it was a certain type of offense after this gentleman had been deported, and so on to trigger the higher.
No,
the higher
I understand
sentence.
That. I mean, the only question is, did Shepard shave off, you know, part of Almendarez-Torres? That's all.
Really, what they didn't say the district court couldn't find facts. They said that the district court can only find facts based on certain evidence.
Right.
Transcripts, judgments of conviction.
But did this district court, that was in a legal setting where those were the things that were relevant. In this legal setting, for the armed career criminal, you know, how do you count the priors? A way of counting them was to look at whether it was a common scheme.
Right, right.
In which case it would have been one. And so there's kind of a fact that has to be found here that's right. A little different.
Right. And Shepard says, what can you consider right. In deciding that? And one of the things they say is a charging document. Look at the pre-sentence report, paragraphs 38 and 39.
They say it's the only, I mean, you know, well, anyway, never mind.
Why not?
It just seems to me that if the district court could have found only one conviction based on the common scheme, then it was and that would have led him not to be sentenced as an armed career criminal. That's an important finding of fact, not based on the charging documents. By definition, based on something different from the charging documents. The district court looks at all the relevant facts, as you're pointing out. How many days apart? You know, what was he doing? You know, different places, different people, different victims, different everything. I mean, it seems like a rather routine finding in the old world. But it's not based on the charging documents. It's based on the commonality of what the guy's doing. It's just an alternate route to the same conclusion.
Obviously the district court's findings of fact are separate and apart from the charging document, but
yeah.
the judge. It's a different thing, but still, the judge, Shepard says, hey, look, the judge can look at the charging document in making
right.
its findings of
right.
fact, and that's exactly what happened here. So the universe has not shifted as it relates to Shepard and what happened in this case.
In any event, you think there ought to be a limited remand.
Send her on back, Your Honor.
However this argument
yep.
comes
yep.
out.
I think a limited remand is appropriate under Palladino. So
right.
I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate you being here. I'll give you a minute, Mr. Habermehl, if you have something else to say. I think you were down to about 10 seconds.
All right. Again, I think there's fairly good agreement from what I can sense that it ought to get sent back under some fashion, if for no other reason than that it was a mandatory sentencing and you can't do that anymore. And I think that was the import of Palladino at its minimum, is that at least you still do that anyway. And this case just highlights that because of the severe increase in sentence from the career offender. But again, I have to say that while there aren't any overt signals one way or the other from the judge as to what she would have done, sending it back to ask the question is asking her either to say, don't confuse me with my facts, my mind is already made up, as in there isn't any conceivable set of facts or any conceivable set of arguments you could present to me that would change my mind, Or she has to say, yes, I gladly would have if only I had known. But I think the most honest answer, again, is going to be, I don't know, because I can't answer the question until I've heard the very things that I didn't hear last time. And that's what I think is wrong with the limited Palladino remand. And I think particularly in a case like this, where she did sentence at the very bottom of the guideline range, that it should just get set back for a straight resentencing and be done with it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And we appreciate your, you were court appointed, were you not, Mr.
Yes.
Thank you very much for your assistance to your client. Thank you, Mr. O'Shea. We will take the case under advisement.